movement that we've been craving for since maybe the 60s. I don't know. Yes. I mean, we got to stay as sane and stable and engaged as we can, and we find the best ways we can to do it. Thank you so much for clarifying
that. Thank you so much, Paul.
All right. And with that, we got to get out of here. This is Paul Rowland, Wednesday Talk Radio. Thanks for listening. Take care.
Thank you for your pause, for your like, for your click. Thank you for your love, for your care, for your kind.
We want to thank everyone who joined or renewed your membership during our fall membership drive here at KBOO. We came very close to our $105,000 goal. We were within $10,000 of it. If you have not donated, please do so. Go to the website kboo.fm/give. Thanks again for supporting the best radio station on earth, KBOO.
Thank you for your post, for your like, for your click.
Yeah, thank you for your great support during our recent fall membership drive. We really appreciate it because KBOO keeps you informed, and you know that, and you can continue to get involved by going to kboo.fm and click where it says donate to become a member if you didn't do it during the drive. This is KBOO. It's 9 o'clock, KBOO Portland, and here's what we have coming up for you on the morning strip for KBOO. At 9 o'clock, the Politics of Living looks at the health of workers in nuclear facilities, the effects of pesticides, living with bipolar disorder, plus the music of Deborah Janani. And then at 10 o'clock, it's Eric Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock on the Bike Show, we examine the way cycling and transportation affect our everyday lives. Thanks for tuning in, and here we go with Politics of Living.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of The Politics of Living. I'm your host, Denise Kowalczyk. This program takes a look at the politics and all that we experience in life, whether it's navigating life with a mental illness, to being a whistleblower to help change the world, to using the power of story to heal. Politics are everywhere. On today's show, Deborah Giannini performs an Iris DeMent song. Tave Fache Drake introduces us to Verslandia Poetry Slam winner Lily LaMadrid. And on the She-Ra Solution, Kristen Thiel talks about Rachel Carson and Karen Silkwood. But first, contributing producer Anessa Anderson chats with Sharon Knorr. She's an actor, writer, producer, director, and storyteller. Her latest project is called Solo Speak, and she's currently developing a monthly storytelling show, Nevertheless, We Persist, Stories by Women. It is her view that storytelling is a powerful art form that can heal both the performer and the listener. We begin with Sharon's story.
I was born in Oregon City, and I'm a leap year baby, and I was the first baby born in the hospital there. My parents lived in Milwaukee, but the only hospital was in Oregon City. And I actually didn't know that till I was older. I was always putting Portland, and my mother finally said, no, we were born in Oregon City. Oh. And I actually lived in Oregon City in a house three doors down from the building that had been that hospital. And when my mother came to visit me, my mother were driving by, three doors down is what's now the Oregon City Rest Home and looks like a set for a Stephen King movie. And she said, oh, that's where you're born. And I went, well, dear God, I don't want to go full circle.
That's good. Yeah. That's good. It's a very interesting place.
It is. I loved living there. I loved living there. I lived in one of the historic houses.
It's very historic, considering that it was almost the capital and mm-hmm. all that kind of thing, the Oregon Trail and all that kind of stuff. You've made moves. You've made some moves out of Portland, back to Portland more recently. It's just been a year since you moved
back. Yes, I was living in Bend for 5 years, and when I was in Bend, I started a storytelling. I don't know. It's hard to call it a company. It's just me, but a storytelling group called Solo Speak, and I started having personal story shows, and then I also started teaching workshops. I do personal stories. I don't tell stories about coyotes or fairy goddesses or anything like that. This is about people's lives. That's what I'm interested in.
People's lives that have intersected yours, or just that you know about them?
Well, I would, when I first started doing shows in Bend, I was asking people that I knew. There was a actor there, a Portland actor who had moved to Bend, and then he had a girlfriend, and then somebody recommended somebody else to me. I chose people that were already performers because I knew I didn't have to at least go through that part of it. And then I just started meeting people. And when I did the workshops, they would be strangers, and they would come to where I was teaching and walk in the door, and I'd think, oh my goodness, you know, they wouldn't look very interesting. Then they'd open their mouths, and my God, the stories that come out of people's mouths and the things that they've gone through. And so I made really, really good friends. Because the thing, what happens is, in a storytelling situation, you meet for, you know, 4 weeks once a week, and you're sharing your, you're spilling your guts, basically, and you get really close to people. And I always say it for my workshops, I promise you, these people are going to be your best friends, and it ends up being that way.
But you began storytelling before you moved to Bend.
I wrote a play, I wrote a show called Why Can't I Marry the Cute Beetle? It was a one-woman show, and I did that a long time ago. And it was a story about, you know, my own life, and my child had died 10 years before, so it was that was part of the show, but it was also funny. It wasn't this huge tragedy. And Lynn Duddy and Lawrence Howard, who are with Portland Story Theater, came to see the show, and they contacted me afterwards, and they said, you know, this is just like telling a long personal story. And I go, yes, it is. And so they invited me to perform in one of their shows and do a, I did a 50-minute version of the of the 90-minute show, and I got hooked on storytelling, and so that's my passion now. I really haven't done any theater for a while, and I'm very available to do on-camera work, but I don't do a lot of that either. And this has really become my passion, because as an actor, especially if you're in a play, you're given other people's words to say. And I've often found myself in a character, the character wanting to say something else, not really expressing what that character's feelings, but the play only gives you these words to use. When you're doing your own story, you really can go to your heart and say what you feel.
Even in the moment. It doesn't have to be totally scripted and stuck to the script.
No, storytelling is not writing a monologue and and just memorizing it. And it's as an actor, that's a hard change to make, you know. And it's just knowing the story so well that you can tell it, and it's your life. I always say to people, if you forget those wonderful words you wrote or that funny little anecdote and you can't remember it, well, it doesn't matter, because it's your story. Just tell the story, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's really satisfying for the people who tell it. And for the listener, my philosophy is that every one of us has a story. We can tell a lot of stories about our life, but there's one thing that makes us special. Unfortunately, my story is that my child died. I try to tell stories that aren't about my child dying, but somehow it comes back to that a lot, because it had such an impact on my life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I have to share with the world, is my experience with that.
I can't think of anything more profound from the mother's standpoint, from a parent's standpoint, from a human standpoint.
And so part of the story is I'm still standing. And so I believe that each of us have a story. And I also believe that there's somebody in the audience. There's a lot of people in the audience, but there's one person in the audience that really needs to hear that story.
Mm-hmm.
And those of us that have the capacity to perform, I mean, I'm like, I'm so transparent, I'll tell you anything about myself. And somebody in the audience doesn't have the facility to articulate their feelings. Sometimes they don't even know that that's what they feel. And I've gotten letters and people waiting after the show, thank you so much for saying that. I just never thought of it that way, or nobody's ever said that. And that's why I think storytelling is so important.
Yeah, and I want to come back to that, because I want to ask you how one can find one's individual story.
Yeah.
What are the steps? It seems like there are steps, and I want to get back to that. But I wanted to talk to you a little bit more about your own persona.
Okay.
And, you know, when I was coming up through my own world of dance and theater, I held such disdain for the world of business. It was like, oh, you're in business? Ugh. I was in the world of the arts. Yes, don't tell me about the business world. But yet, you are very coordinated in the business world, and you know how to make your way through it. You actually have a gift, you know, because of that.
Well,
you are able to do certain things that I can't. I'm kind of like all right-brained, and you manage to make a...
I do.
I think you've managed to balance the left and the right brain, meaning the right brain is the artistic one, and the left is the one that can take the notes and figure out, okay, how am I going to organize this business-wise? Mm-hmm. You know, really have that
in you. Well, that's my producer hat.
Mm-hmm. And that you can wear with facility.
And I lived in L.A. for a while and worked at a production company. I was a bookkeeper, and I saw what the producers were doing, and I thought, well, I can do that, you know. And I was moving back to Portland, and I made a bold decision that that's what I wanted to be. And
A producer.
And I was 40 years old, and I always say I have the four best components of being a producer. Number one, I was a bookkeeper, so I'm really good with numbers and budgets and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. It doesn't scare me. I can figure it out. Number two, I was an actress, so I've been in the business. I understand how being in front of a camera, I understand directors and that kind of stuff. Number three, I was a mother, and I've taken care of people. I can feed them. I can get them a room to sleep in, that kind of thing. And number four, I was a wife, so I can tell people they're wonderful, even if I don't believe it myself.
All those little lies.
Yeah.
Not all of them are lies, but you know. You have these very unique qualifications, good at managing people and not afraid to make decisions, which is somebody needs to be the decider.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the decider in chief.
Yeah.
So that brings us to solo speak. Let's talk about how you came to storytelling, though, originally, you know, back when you were a kid, something that made you observant of people.
Yes.
And something that made you be able to go inside yourself.
Well,
and when do you first feel like you could do that?
I was an actress from the very beginning. I mean, I was standing in front of our stereo playing Bye Bye Birdie and West Side Story and singing and dancing and acting. My mother loved old movies, so, and my father liked music, so I did have that background. I think it started when I would be looking for auditions, or I'd be in a show and there just wasn't anything that would speak to me, so I would start writing my own audition pieces. Mm-hmm. And I was in a show called Icon, which was a Rick Young show in Storefront many, many years ago.
Right.
And I saw very...
Storefront Theater right there off of...
Burnside, Third and Burnside.
Burnside. Mm-hmm.
It's now the Paris Theater. And I saw very quickly that I was just going to walk around and wear pretty dresses and not do much, and that wasn't okay with me. So I wrote a monologue about somebody who'd been a... Icon was about Marilyn Monroe and the death of Marilyn Monroe. And so I wrote a monologue about someone who'd been like an extra in Hollywood for years and always was the third woman on the right or the serving girl or something like that. And the monologue was, why did she get famous and I didn't? And
interesting.
And I wrote it.
Or fourth spear carrier from the left.
Exactly,
kind of
exactly. And, you know,
plays.
Doing that for years. Mm-hmm. And I gave it to Rick, and he went, wow, this is fabulous. And I think I closed the first half, and the opening night I got a 5-minute standing ovation. So that was, I think, the first time I saw that doing my own stuff, I wasn't writing about my own life, but I was putting my own feelings into this character. Mm-hmm. I think that was the first time when I saw that, wow, I really like this. And the other thing, after my son died, I really wanted to do something where I could connect with the audience. In theater, we have the fourth wall. You're not supposed to be talking directly into somebody's face.
Right.
And
the
I wanted,
traditional theater.
Exactly. And
that's,
I wanted...
That's changing a lot.
It is. And I wanted to be able to really connect with the audience. And I was called up to be in a musical theater band group called Hot Flashes the Musical, which we...
I remember that.
Yeah,
I
which
went to
we
see a show.
Did for over 10 years. And I was kind of... I didn't play... It was a real band where women played the instruments and sang and told jokes. I don't play an instrument. I just sing and tell jokes. So I was the one who talked. But there was no fourth wall in that show. And that was exactly what I needed. It was such fun. And I liked it because I could talk right to the people in the audience.
Mm-hmm. Make that connection.
Yeah, make that connection. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of, and then when I did my one-woman show, which was something I'd always wanted to do, and, you know, I wasn't getting any younger, and you think, okay. And so I just took all the stories I'd been telling my friends at cocktail parties and so forth. I'm always the one talking. And I put them together in a show. And it was really satisfying, really, really satisfying. And then I helped Walter Cole, who is Darcel, write and perform his one-man show called Just Call Me Darcel. So it was another incident of helping somebody tell their story. And Darcel says that everybody should do their own person show or write it, even if they never perform it, because what happens to you as a person, just getting all this stuff out of you. That we had one rehearsal, we did a fall run, and then we were going to redo it in the spring. And so we were rehearsing to get it back up. Mm-hmm. And he was on stage. He'd already done the show. He was on stage, and we were rehearsing, and he came to a part about his father. I won't go into the problem, but he came to a part, and he said something he'd never said before. And he was 80 years old, and he started sobbing.
Darcel did.
Sobbing. And we had to quit. We had to quit the rehearsal. And he goes, what is that about? I thought I was all done with that. But storytelling, which is what he was doing, it's like a cauldron with molasses boiling in it, and these slow bubbles come up to the top. And one of those bubbles that had been in his being all these years came to the top and burst, and all this emotion came out, and it's very healing.
Yeah, very, very valuable.
Yeah,
I mean, certainly when you started because of your son, mm-hmm. that's your story. And you say that storytelling is a powerful art form that can heal the performer as well as the listener.
Yeah,
and that's very much part of the mantra of solo speak.
Yes.
And also because, as you mentioned, in these times of our phones, we're always looking at our phones. That's how we're speaking. We're speaking through Facebook instead of one-on-one, and it's profoundly different to have that one-on-one conversation. So I find that very valuable for me, too. I remember recently I had a musician friend over, and he said, oh my God, can I book another session with you? You're my psychotherapist. Because he has a chance to speak.
Absolutely.
And I have specific questions I might want to ask, but once you start speaking, mm-hmm. things do cauldron up, as you talked about it, as Darcel said. It's a transforming event. So tell me, Nevertheless We Persist, Stories by Women, how did this concept come up for you? You do mention stories by women. A man could do this, but for you, that's what you call it.
Well, and I may do a show with men later on, but
give them a little space there, too, of course.
Like everyone else, like some of us, I have not been happy with events that since January 20th in our country or even in our world. And I went to the Women's March with my granddaughter and a friend, and it was so wonderful. I mean, the sight of policemen with, those pink knit hats on their heads smiling at us was wonderful. And I quit going to peace marches and all those things years ago because they're not really about peace. You don't make any change if you're standing on a corner yelling at the person across the street who thinks differently than you and getting into fights and so forth. That's not going to change the way anybody thinks. And I wanted to get something going with storytelling here in Portland. And the phrase, Nevertheless We Persist, just means a lot to me. And I believe that women's lives, because that's what this series is going to start with, is women's lives, just living their lives. We go through, our childhood and we're marriage and babies and working life and death and cancer and abuse and drugs and all the things that happen in people's lives. Just a woman standing and telling her particular story about whatever thing happened to her, and the fact that she's still there, the fact that we continue, the fact that she's standing strong and still talking, I mean, that's all it takes, is to show how women do persist. Women go on. And we know that if the world was run by women, we wouldn't be in this mess.
That's what we know. And yet,
yeah, Yeah.
Nevertheless, we persist. Yeah. There it is. There's your title.
Yeah.
So that leads me to ask you, for those listening, as they consider what their stories might be, I mean, we have so many stories, as you say, how do you identify from all that different stuff what it is that your story might be? For you, it almost seems easy because this monumental thing happened to you.
Well, and I've told lots of stories about that, and I'm at the point now where I'm looking around going, well, what else can I tell a story about? And I did do a story about my parents called The Ballad of Lois and Leo, and I've done stories about, I did stories about before my child was born, you know, and so there are other stories. And when I teach a workshop, and possibly for the show too, I ask people to come with, you know, two or three ideas of what they think they might want to talk about. And in the workshops, if people are just starting out, they might not want to tell the big, huge,
huge story
yet.
Uh-huh.
They might want to wait till the next time. I want them to take a risk, but I don't want them to be sobbing on stage. And you have to have healed from the story. We tell stories from our scars, not our wounds. If a story is too new, if your husband died 4 months ago, it's much too soon to tell the story
about
him.
Or say you have an opioid addiction, it's still too new.
Yes, absolutely.
You're still struggling with it.
And you have to have some sort of
closure, maybe, or
some. It never closes, but there's little closures that happen all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But people do come in with an idea of the thing that they would want. I mean, I think it nags at them. I think it, you know, it's like, no, this is the one I want to say. I do have people come in who like want to tell their whole life story, and I go, no, you've got, you know, 12 to 15 minutes. You have to pick one event out of this whole. I said, when you do your one woman show, then you can do all that stuff.
Yeah.
But for this, I want one incident that stands out the most. And we get it down, you know, we get it down. I'm editing. I'm cut. Too many words. Too long. That's what I do as a coach. And I always imagine like a series of colanders, you know, colanders where you put your spaghetti in it to get the water out. And they're on top of each other, and the holes get smaller and smaller and smaller. So you put the story in the top. It's got too many words. It's too long. And it sifts down through all of those colanders. And at the bottom is this pile of a 12 to 15 minute story that is really the nugget of what you feel and what you want to communicate to other people. And the question is always, what is it I want to say? What is it I want to say? And even me, when I'm putting a story together, I go back and I get kind of lost, or it doesn't seem very interesting. I go, what is it I'm trying to say here? What am I trying to articulate and get out of my own psyche?
You have to really delve deeply.
Yes.
Into your soul.
I have a friend who calls me the story doula, because I really, that's what I want to do. They'll tell me events, and I'll go back and say, all right, I want to know how you felt when this was happening. And for some people, it's really hard. And some people, I'm not going to hit them over the head. But for some people, just delving a little bit into their feelings is all they can do. And that's great. I had one woman in Bend who's Native American, and her life is so fascinating, but she is the shyest person on the planet. She is so wonderful, but she's so shy, and she really wanted to tell her story, but she couldn't look at the audience, and she couldn't, you know,
the way she was raised.
She just couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And she makes these beautiful drums, Native American drums. So I put her on a stool with a music stand because she was having a hard time with her words. It was the only person I ever let do this. We had her script on the stand, and she beat that drum in between things that she wanted to say. And it was so moving. It looked like an artistic choice, but it was really something to make her comfortable.
To ground her, yeah.
And she got that story out, and the audience was crying. It was so moving because we did it her way, you know.
Right. It sounds like it was amazing.
It was.
That kind of drumming anyway. Drumming is so powerful in and of itself that that it's. Can I use a drum?
Maybe.
<No. laughs> maybe a tinkly piano. That's my instrument. Well, yeah, it's interesting. I'm looking forward to the first one. It comes up in November.
Yes.
And tell me more about where, how,
all right.
You know.
Well, Don Horn at Triangle Productions, which is on 17th and Northeast Sandy. He has a main stage where he does shows, but then he's also in the last couple of years created another space inside his building or the floor of the building that he is on, which is a cabaret space. And it's got 45 chairs. It's called the Boardroom Cabaret. And so it's perfect for storytelling because it's small and intimate. It's got a little, you know, raised stage at one end, and we don't need mics or anything like that. And it's going to be perfect. And we're going to do two nights, Friday and Saturday, once a month. I have the theater booked until once a month until March, but I'm hoping that I can go through June.
That gets traction and
yes.
So,
yes.
Is there a specific date that you can share with us yet?
It's going to be the second weekend of every month, and tickets are online at solospeak.com for the November show.
Right, we'll make sure that we get all those links up.
For
our listeners.
Okay.
So, nevertheless, we persist. Stories by women. So it really does reflect on the not necessarily reflecting on the political climate, but I think that many women have been brought to their knees, literally, by what's happened.
Yes.
Do we really have to fight this fight all over again, kind of a thing?
Yes.
During my college years, I fought the environmental fight. I fought the women's rights fight. Why are we fighting this again is mm-hmm, the question, mm-hmm, and that's mm-hmm. why we're doing this.
Yeah, and I say to the women, you know, this isn't an anti-Trump thing. It's not a man-bashing thing. It's not a, oh, poor us, how we've suffered thing. I'm just hoping that with our everyday struggles, that will show how we've been affected by events in the world. I don't know that yet. We'll have to see how the stories come out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Facebook is an interesting entity because I've had women that we know write long things about their mother or something like that, and I'll read that and I'll go, wow, this is such a great story.
I have noticed a lot of people, men and women, Facebook, and younger people too, have taken to these very long, not diatribes, but for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
What is a better word? A diatribe, I guess, in a sense. But, you know, it's like, oh boy, this is going to be one of those long reads instead of like a haiku.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's not Twitter, 100, whatever, 43 words, but it's like, I've really noticed that. I think people have a need right now to express themselves.
Exactly.
And so this is a great place to hear the expression and to express the expression. So I'm very appreciative of what you've started here.
Thank you. Thank you.
And,
I'm excited.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a very, very interesting trip. And finally, anything lurking in the corner and calling your name, I can't imagine that it's not, calling your name that you have yet to fulfill, that you've thought, well, I'm doing this thing right now, but...
Well, the other thing that I'm going to do, is I've always wanted to work with veterans to tell their stories. And so there's a place in Portland called Post 134. Do you know where that is? It's on Alberta. And it is a American Legion. It's a Quonset hut on like 21st in Alberta.
I am familiar with it.
Mm-hmm. Funny place, you know, you go in, they got that old bar, mm-hmm. you know, and mm-hmm. all the old veterans are back there drinking and, you know, they get a scotch for $3 or mm-hmm. something. I went to a reading series there called Grief Rites, and it's people who have lost children.
Grief Rites,
R-I-T-E-S, and it's a monthly reading series, authors and people, but I went one time, and then the next time I told a story. And the woman that runs that was talking about a man named Sean Davis, who was the head of the provost, I don't know what they would call the head of that American Legion, and for thanking him for letting her use the space and blah, blah, blah. Well, she said, and he's right back there at the bar. When I heard that, I popped up and I had my little card out and I said, Sean, I want to tell stories with veterans. I said, would you guys be interested in something like that? And he goes, oh my God, yes, we would. So we did a show. It's a long story, but Sean has connections with theaters as a expert in the Army. Anytime they do anything military, they call him up to help them make it authentic. And so we did a show at Portland Center Stage in their educational series on Monday, four veterans, three men and a woman, and we did, you know, we worked it together. We would meet once a week, and they told their stories, and we had a Q&A afterwards, And we could have been there all night long with people asking them questions. And the power of storytelling was so big there. I mean, I had people saying, you know, you have totally changed my idea of what I thought was going on over there. Somebody else said, I thought soldiers just were wanting to go over there and kill everybody. And I can see now that you have a lot of humanity. And I'm thank you so much for this. So one of the young men in this group, he's out fighting fires right now, but when he gets back, he says, I want to do this. He said, telling my story, I'd never told it before. And he said, it really, really helped me. And I want to do this. So in the fall, I'm going to start having groups at Post 134. And we can do shows there, but our goal is really to get it out to, you know, regular folks so that they can hear what these young people are going through and maybe think about that before they vote for somebody who's going to have more wars. And as Sean Davis said, you won't find any more anti-war people than these people up on stage.
Sharon, it's been an amazing journey listening to you talk about your journey, and I thank you very much for sharing.
Thank you for having me here, and it's so great to see you.
That was storyteller Sharon Knorr speaking with Anessa Anderson. You can learn more about her projects by visiting SharonKnorrProductions.com, and that's K-N-O-R-R. Or check out the links on our show page by visiting KBOO.FM and searching for The Politics of Living. Next up, The She-Ra Solution is a monthly biography of women, past and present, hosted by Kristen Thiel. Its title is inspired by Maria Theresa Hart's article, She-Ra and the Fight Against the Token Girl, published in The Atlantic. On today's segment, Kristen talks about Rachel Carson and Karen Silkwood, two whistleblowers who helped change the world.
Rachel Carson grew up along the banks of the Allegheny River in quiet Springdale, Pennsylvania. The early 1900s must have been a wonderful time to see nature relatively untouched by human hand. And Rachel took advantage of that, exploring the forests of her family's hilly 65-acre farm, sometimes by herself and sometimes with her mother, who mentored her in caring about the environment. Young Rachel also wrote. Her first piece was published in a children's magazine when she was 10 years old. This steered her college decision. She enrolled in Pennsylvania College for Women as an English major. But the natural world kept tugging at her. Midway through her 4 years, she switched her major to biology and even enjoyed a summer fellowship at the U.S. Marine Laboratory. Receiving that honor was just the first in a line of impressive accomplishments. Her next award was relatively unheard of for women in 1929. Rachel received a scholarship to complete her graduate work in biology at Johns Hopkins University. She continued to blend her skills in writing and science. The Baltimore Sun and its syndicated newspapers published her articles on conservation. In these pieces, she urged the passage of government regulation against, quote, forces of destruction. She asked people to consider the needs of the, quote, fish as well as that of the fishermen. In 1935, she accepted a part-time position with the U.S. Bureau of Fisheries and created a series of 7-minute radio programs on marine life with the bewitching name Romance Under the Waters. Only a year later, she was appointed junior aquatic biologist at the Bureau of Fisheries, one of only 2 women employed at the Bureau at that level. Even the U.S. military requested her assistance during World War II. She participated in an investigation of undersea life and environment to help the Navy improve its submarine detection. Carson's first book was published in 1941. Under the Sea Wind's clear, poetic explanation of nature won readers over. I think it's safe to say that Rachel also had a knack for writing titles. In 1943, only 8 years after she had started working as a part-timer, she became a full aquatic biologist in the new U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. She continued to bring science to the people with regular pamphlet series on everything from exploring nature to how to prepare fish to eat. At the time, a diet of fresh fish was not common for many Americans. Later, as editor-in-chief of all Fish and Wildlife Service publications, she had vast responsibilities with manuscript preparation and library functioning. She also prepared congressional testimony for Fish and Wildlife Service personnel. In hindsight, perhaps this work also prepared her to step before Congress. In 1963, she was asked to testify about the findings in her book, Silent Spring. In her book, she argued that pesticides, in particular DDT, were destroying the ecosystem. Rachel was not casual in her publishing of Silent Spring. She was very aware of how tricky a subject it was. She had evidence that DDT, the first modern synthetic insecticide, was harming the planet, but she also knew modern agriculture relied on chemicals. For a long time, she hoped someone else would expose the ugly facts. No one did. Finally, Rachel could stay silent no longer. Her call to action in her book was not a ban of pesticides, but for further study of safe use of pesticides and the development of safer alternatives to the most dangerous ones. The pesticide industry led a campaign to discredit her, but Congress asked her to testify, and that testimony led to the ban of DDT. In 1964, a year after she appeared before Congress, Rachel had died of breast cancer, a disease she'd battled for years at the same time as she worked for the greater good. And 10 years after that, in 1974, another woman who refused to put her personal safety ahead of her truth also died, also too young, but in quite a different way. Karen Silkwood was born in 1946 in Longview, Texas. For 26 of what would be only 28 years of life, Karen lived quietly and privately. She dropped out of college, where she had been studying science, and got married. But when she divorced, she moved to Oklahoma City, headquarters for Kerr McGee Corporation's oil and nuclear complex, and landed a job at its plutonium plant. Karen was open-minded about the company's research, but as soon as she understood better the extreme hazards of plutonium, she became concerned that management wasn't being thoughtful in its handling of the substance. She thought the Kerr McGee plant was sloppy, dishonest, and unsafe. She didn't just worry privately, she spoke out. While her coworkers applauded her courage, even electing her to the local steering committee of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers International Union, the higher-ups were not as interested in hearing her perspective. And they had been some of the most powerful people in the country for a while by then. The company's founder, Robert Kerr, had been governor of Oklahoma, ran for president as a Democrat in 1952, and, at the time of his death in 1963, was a powerful senator. Dean McGee, Kerr's successor at the company, advised President Kennedy on defense policies and President Ford on energy. With her union's encouragement, Karen began working undercover to gather company files. Soon, she felt she had enough documents of interest, and she set a meeting with a reporter from the New York Times. She gathered the documents and got in her Honda. She didn't make it to the meeting. Her car hit a concrete culvert wall and swerved off the road. The reason why was murky. Her autopsy showed alcohol and prescription sedatives in her system, which may have caused her to fall asleep. It also showed she had been exposed to large amounts of radiation. Not only did she work near radioactivity, of course, but plutonium contamination had been found in her apartment as well, in her bathroom, and in a bologna and cheese sandwich in her refrigerator. Kerr McGee's lawyers suggested she'd poisoned herself. Those who knew her argued against that. In addition, a private investigator found evidence that she could have been pushed off the road. The highway patrolman who helped at the scene of the accident said he'd picked up documents that had scattered across the highway and put them back in Karen's car. Those were the ones Karen had taken from work and was planning to leak to the New York Times. When Karen's friends claimed her car the next day, the documents were gone. Karen's death ended up being another beginning in Karen's story. Her death, the mysteriousness of it, as well as what it revealed of her undercover work, kicked off a whole new layer to the investigation. It even led to another young woman, journalist Jackie Shruji, working undercover, obtaining secret documents, and coming up against a huge, powerful force trying to stop her. But that's a story for another time. For today, we're just meeting Rachel Carson and Karen Silkwood, two women who gave everything in their pursuit of a very big something. I'm your host, Kristen Thiel, and I'll be back next month.
That was Kristen Thiel with this month's The She-Ra Solution. To learn more about the women featured, check out the links on the show page by visiting KBOO.FM and searching for The Politics of Living. Contributor Tave Fashe Drake has a great respect for today's youth, particularly their fresh perspective on facing challenges with strength, humor, and personal innovation. A mother of two teenage daughters herself, Tave invited their friend, Verslandia Poetry Slam winner Lily La Madrid, into the studio to talk about her bipolar illness. She also offers some really profound slam poems on the very same subject.
My name is Lily La Madrid. I'm 18. I live here in Portland, Oregon, best city on the planet. I'm a high school senior at Franklin High. I'm a slam poet here in town. I won the Verslandia competition put on by Literary Arts. Oh, and I got second place the year before. Anyway, I'm going to be performing some pieces based off of my experience with my mental illness. So yeah, here we go. It's not just the fire in your belly. You have to have the bile in your throat. Kellyanne Conway. Dear Miss Conway, I want to be you when I grow up. Dear Miss Conway, the other girls on the playground say things like, you're an affront to feminism everywhere, or you speak with a self-interested evil that demeans the rights of millions. And while I might agree, my admiration remains unmitigated. See, Miss Conway, you are ambition personified. Lawyer turned pollster turned media icon. Dear Miss Conway, I've watched you on TV and I'm awestruck the way you dance a ballet between the lines of reality and spin. They play NBA games after Meet the Press, but you're the one who truly pivots. Miss Conway, alternative facts. Alternative facts. How amazing, a rhetorical invention to flip hundreds of years of epistemological structure on its head in a single sentence. It's unbelievable. Dear Miss Conway, I have an overproduction of bile on account of my psychiatric medications. Dear Miss Conway, sometimes I am really good at speaking, can argue my way from Pride and Prejudice to prison industrial complex in 5 seconds flat. My mouth turned transcontinental high-speed rhyme machine. I waltz vowels off my tongue and slide music through my teeth. Only 17 days in breathing starts to seem like a waste of time. Because my body feels more wings than bones, air meant to lift, not saturate this bile-ridden ambition that makes my hands shake and the whole world turn into a mess of blinding opportunity where everything is hilarious and the rain is really just alternative sunshine. I hate the things you say. You. Me. I hate watching myself speak sometimes, feeling a huddled mass in the back of my throat, yearning to breathe free, but only ever coming out in staccato eruptions that rake across my teeth. I watch my world burn, happy for the heat. You, me, this boiling decline, this sounding torrent directed toward a holy grail. White-knuckled fists will never find a child's ambition and a brilliant mind, a brittle mind, a broken mind, a belly full of fire, and a brain riddled with misplaced bile. Dear, do you ever regret that threat which keeps ambition from becoming monster? You, monster. Me, monster. Dear Miss Conway, the other girls on the playground tell ghost stories and I hear your name. Dear Miss Conway, I want to speak like you someday, to spin and pivot and watch my tongue dance. But I want to be able to believe it. I'm cheating. I don't have depression exactly. I have bipolar disorder, which is a disease that alternates between cycles of depression, which is the topic of this program, and then mania, which is high mood, high energy, little sleep, but also risky decision making. You see a lot of drug use, risky sexual behavior, and often, for a lot of people, including myself, it gives way to psychosis. So that's delusions, hallucinations, breakdown in formal thinking, which a lot of people aren't familiar with. But breakdown in formal thinking means that, like, you can't think anymore, which is very scary. It's one thing to see a man with a knife behind a tree that does not exist. It's another thing to literally not be able to put that experience into words any longer. I've experienced both. And written poems on each topic. I'm not a doctor and I'm not super active in the many advocacy programs that exist for this domain of psychiatric whatever. But I definitely hear my treatment team and those around me in the support groups I've gone to calling it bipolar disorder, calling it a disease and an illness, because synonyms are good when you're writing. You don't want to be too repetitive. That's what I learned from fourth grade English. I don't like it when people say that I'm bipolar and they use it as an adjective. And I feel a slightly hypocritical when I say that, because a lot of people will say like, oh yeah, I'm diabetic, so I should be able to say, oh yeah, I'm bipolar. But I feel like stigma has put us to a point where we aren't quite able to put those on equal ground yet. So I shy away from using bipolar as an adjective and will say I have bipolar disorder, or, oh my God, that actress has bipolar disorder. Manic depression, I think, is outdated terminology. I'm not super offended by it. I just think that usually when people are using it, it's indicative that they aren't fully aware of the current state of what we know about the illness. And there's a reason we gave it a new name, because we needed to move forward with what we knew. What do you call a bunch of people waiting for what looks like red lemonade? It's a punchline. And what do you call a scholarly summary of your favorite desserts? It's a treat. It's funny because these are symptoms of my mood disorder. What do you call two white bears sitting in a room? Bipolar. And was the earth bipolar? And what am I when I'm manic? Bipolar. You know, they say this disease is chronic, so they stuck me on mood stabilizers and antipsychotics. What do you call your mom's crazy sister? Antipsychotic. You know, I can't read on this medication. They call this palliation. I swear it feels like incarceration. What's black and white and red all over? A newspaper. Something I can't read. A sunburned penguin with a poker face. Someone no one can read. And what do heretical fish speak? Bass. For me. And why don't people move after they've killed themselves? They're suicidal. And why? Do sad pants always look so good? They're depressed. And why are waterfowl so crazy? Well, they're all loon, a ticks, and what do you call a country with a psychotic population? It's a hallucination. And what do you tell a future alcoholic up on petty problems? Stop whining. And how do dishonest people make soap? They use lies. My psychiatrist says I hide behind humor. Consider it a coping mechanism. I wrap my worries in witticisms, hide my doubts behind punchlines, my pain under puns. I have built an armor of derision. My plates produced with precision. Go ahead, try to find a chink in my chainmail. You will fail when you find. I'll carry my deadpan to the grave. Serious. On the other hand, is not my strong suit. Serious makes me uncomfortable. I am scared I will make you uncomfortable if I let you see the ugly part. This disease is the monster that used to live under your bed, doing a bunch of cocaine and then nestling itself inside of your soul. If I were to show you my monster, all grown up, I would not blame you for running. And yet I know that you'll be standing right here when I find a way to tell you about the bad days without the melee of mockery. What do you do when you're lonely in a boat? You go looking for friendships. And what do you do if you're not sure if a Scandinavian is done? You ask him if he's finished. Duh. And how do you end a poem with a pun? I'm not sure, but I'm gonna poetry. How do you cure a mood disorder? For this one, I don't know the punchline. So I think that one of the really important things people need to realize about mental illness is that depression is really hard and other mental illnesses are really hard, but oftentimes the treatment can be just as hard. So I'm on Depakote, and it's given me increased ammonia levels in my body, which in some ways turns you into an Alzheimer's patient as a young teen, a youth. I have issues with short-term memory, confusion. I always lose my phone and keys. Here it's happening. I have trouble finding words. And also, my tongue trips over itself often. So I did like a bunch of tongue twisters and stuff before I came in to get like to work that and stuff. But when you're having to think about speech, it'll come out like, because I'm tripping over my words. That's what's tripping me up right now. I'll try to pronounce a word and it'll come out the wrong way with the sounds in the wrong order, or I'll say a sentence and the words will be in the wrong order. I have a lot of side effects. I also have joint pain, fatigue. But the thing is, I'm not crazy, and that's really amazing, and medicine is amazing. When we're having these discussions about parity for mental illness and stuff, we need to not only talk about treating the diseases with the same respect, but also the side effects of treatment with the same respect that we give to those who are going through chemo and diabetes, insulin stuff. So I do slam poetry, and I love it because I write these 3-minute pieces of words, and so much of my illness revolves around language and an increased facility with language or a decreased facility with language depending on where I'm cycling or what medications I've been put on. But I can write these poems and I can practice them and practice them and practice them, and then at some point I have 3 minutes of words that I can just return to and just revel in and perform, and then I get to share those words with other people, and I get to talk, and I get to say exactly what I want to say without having to worry about tripping or faltering or being too sick. It's one of those venues where you're never quite too sick, and that's nice, because when you get sick at such a young age, there's a lot of times you're too sick to do stuff. I'm not one of those people who doesn't believe in God because they got sick. I don't lack faith because some doctor told me there's some self-destruct button behind my eyes and a Salt and Pepper cover band singing, "Push it real good." However, it snowed 4 inches last week, then froze over. My psychiatrist appointment got canceled, and I am sick. Like joint pain, fatigue, numb legs, sick. Like unbearable sadness meets psychosis, sick. Like what girl doesn't want gain 10 pounds and become a before picture for Cetaphil 2 weeks before Christmas family portrait, sick. Truth is, I didn't believe in God even before my brain went to hell. However, both my grandparents are these Midwestern Protestant ministers. We have 7 nativity scenes on display in our living room. I didn't have an imaginary friend growing up. I had Jesus. I had scripture before bed and the gospel etched into my breakfast cereal. Mind you, this was never in a fire and brimstone, burn the faggot sort of terror. It was more that I saw faith best practiced on the first days of fall when the rain started and summer oil slid off onto side streets, casting car tires into uncertain skids that, oh God, and intermingled in the driver's seat. Prayer is a practice best employed before rolling the dice in Monopoly, and faith is not an act of blind bravery, but a morning cup of coffee, eyes turned wide open by warmth. My grandma asked what I believed in, and I said comedy. She said, make that your church. You can choose your own Bible. I'm not one of those people who doesn't believe in Tina Fey because they got sick. I just read her memoir and marveled at how lucky some people get, and some get Salt and Pepper soundtracks. There are 3 synoptic gospels in the Bible. Matthew, Mark, and Luke tell the story of Jesus in basically the same way. And then there's John, who speaks of Christ as some combination of word and light. Not quite man, not quite poem. There's so many ways to tell a joke. The main thing is just that the audience doesn't see the punchline coming, like when Mary rolls back the stone to find an empty tomb, or we all sit on the edge of our seats, unsure why the chicken crossed the road, the doctors don't know what's going to happen to me. So they prescribe pills and preach optimism and recommend hope as though it is some over-the-counter commodity. So I replay Kate McKinnon singing Hallelujah on a Saturday night because that just might be the best prayer I've ever heard. And I've heard so many prayers and hymns and my grandmother's stories and the sound of faith. A ringing bell, a major lift, laughter. So there's this thing in slam poetry where if you take part of someone's poem, whether it be format or topic or like a line, you say after their name. And so this piece is built off of the work of a couple other poems. It's after Brenna Tui, after Desiree Dallagiacomo. Conversations about high school with Tim, my psychiatrist. So they take these 1,600 teens, right, and they put them together in a school. And they tell them to build an identity out of math and textbooks. And then friends say ridiculous stuff. Like, I wonder if maybe you're trying too hard. Or, no, really, she doesn't like you. And then everybody says, I am not a child. And then everyone cries. Like, all the time, Tim. They are always crying. And then, like, they have to write an essay about of mice and men. And Linny kills soft things. Good things. Has sprinkled their bodies all over Central California. And George told him, buddy, I want you around, but you always kill mice. And George cares so much, so they pretend a life they will not have and say it will make things better. And when I'm sick, but not real sick, like mentally ill doesn't feel valid sick, we are at a party. Just us and so many people. We sit next to the bathroom all night, and I puke 17 times until my stomach was acid and it hurt to breathe. And she cares, despite this mental defect, says she loves me. Only we don't say, I love you. We tell ourselves we'd fight bears for the other, accumulate scars and sprains, take on the terrifying, and I think this is better. This metaphor, this promise, this inside secret, I'd kill Winnie the Pooh for that girl, and I mean it. But I love her too much, love her like I love to be manic, stupid and dangerous and rib-splitting too muchness, and George shoots Lenny, Tim. And you're not supposed to see it coming, but you kind of see it coming. I'm not sure if you ever fully see things like this coming. And I hate when people talk about insanity without talking about the boring parts. And I'm picking off scabs off my nose as I write this. And I wonder if that's a metaphor. She asks if I'm manic. The number one rule of being crazy is you do not lie. But Lord, if I didn't speak omissions to protect her from this fear... Lord, if I am not riddled with fear and a rib-splitting too muchness. If you want to get in touch with me, I have an email address at lmlamadrid, that's L-A-M-A-D-R-I-D, at gmail.com. I'm one of those people that's like, social media is a little toxic for society, so I stay off of it for the most part. I don't have a website. I'm not that cool.
Next up, Deborah Giannini returns this month and performs one of her favorite Iris DeMent songs. All of Iris's songs can often feel like you're going to an old-timey church, but also include incredible words elevating her political voice. Here's Deborah Giannini with When My Morning Comes Around.
When my morning comes around, no one else will be there, so I won't have to worry what I'm supposed to say. I alone will know, I climbed that great big mountain, and that's all that really matters. Morning comes around. When my morning comes around, I'll look back on this valley, to the streets and the alleys I called home. The place where I now live could soon be down to ashes, like so many memories. When my morning comes around, 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 I know my morning's coming round. When my morning's coming round, from a new cup I'll be drinking, and for once I won't be thinking that there's something wrong with me. I'll awake and find that I have been forgiven, and I can go on living when my morning comes around. When my morning comes around, when my morning comes around, when my morning comes around, I know my morning's coming round.
Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of The Politics of Living. Thanks to our contributors, Kristen Thiel, Anessa Anderson, Tavi Fashe-Drake, and Deborah Giannini. Also, thanks to our technical editor, Liam Delta, and web manager, Vicky Mazzone. Thanks so much for listening to The Politics of Living. I'm your host, Denise Kowalczyk. Have a great day.
It's 9:59 here at KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary. And then at 10:15, we got Flashpoints coming with Dennis Bernstein. And 11 o'clock, the bike show examines the way cycling and transportation affect our everyday lives. We're going to hear a couple of announcements before we get to Air Cascadia.
KBOO Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Dead Moon Night, Thursday, October 5th at 6 p.m. at the outdoor portico of Portland City Hall. Dead Moon Night is a celebration of the Portland band Dead Moon. An official proclamation declaring that day as Dead Moon Night will be read along with surprise musical guests, refreshments, and an exhibit about Dead Moon. Again, that's Dead Moon Night, Thursday, October 5th at 6 p.m. at the outdoor portico of Portland City Hall, 1221 Southwest